Admitted. We'll hear arguments next in Norfolk Redevelopment against Chesapeake and Potomac Telephone Company. Crenshaw, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the question in this case is whether the respondent telephone company is eligible under the terms of the Uniform Relocation Assistance and Real Properties Acquisition Policies Act of 1970 to be reimbursed for its cost when it disconnects transmission lines beneath certain streets in the city of Norfolk, Virginia, and rebuilds replacement lines under new streets. The claim was submitted to the Petitioner Redevelopment Authority and was denied because it felt that the common law requires a utility company to move its transmission lines at its expense, and the Uniform Act did not change the common law. Furthermore, the telephone company did not meet the threshold requirements for eligibility under the Uniform Act because it did not move personal property and it did not move any property as a result of the acquisition of land. Now, the telephone company had installed its facilities in the streets of Norfolk pursuant to a franchise with the city of Norfolk, by virtue of which it had a mere license. It was a franchisee, and it is the established common law in Virginia and in the overwhelming majority of other states that a utility company having such a franchise has the obligation of moving its lines at its own expense when the public good requires those lines to be relocated. This is a long-standing and well-understood and respected custom, and the opinion of the Circuit Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit would change that rule. Now, in this case, these transmission lines were rerouted because of the execution by the Petitioner Redevelopment Authority of conservation and redevelopment projects within the city of Norfolk. Under those projects, areas of blighted property were acquired, the old buildings were demolished, and the cleared land was made available for redevelopment. In certain instances, it was necessary and desirable to rearrange certain streets. And the Redevelopment Authority petitioned the city of Norfolk to close streets so that the new street pattern could be established, and the city did close those streets. And in a very cooperative manner, the city, the petitioner, and the city of Norfolk worked together with the telephone company to work out an arrangement for the new streets to be built in a manner that the public and the private utilities could be laid within those streets with a minimum of inconvenience to all of the parties. There was no coercion, no eminent domain. It was all done in a friendly and matter-of-fact way, and there was no request for any reimbursement. over a year after the redevelopment work had been done and the new streets had been laid, the telephone company filed its claim, which had been denied. I think it's important that the court recognize the nature of the facilities that are here involved. By and large, they are massive, they are permanent, they are embedded in the ground, and we have contended they have become real estate. They consist primarily of conduits, which are about 4 inches in diameter, which carry copper cables, which have as many as 3,600 pairs in them. Those conduits extend between underground vaults, which are known as manholes. These manholes are larger than a man is tall. They're like a little subterranean room. The walls are a foot thick. They have a collar that connects the top of those manholes to the street.
And Mr. when the new Crenshaw, street... I suppose the Fourth Circuit has determined that as a matter of state law, these things were personal property. Is that right?
Justice O'Connor, I think that the Fourth Circuit must have been persuaded by the telephone company's interpretation of transcontinental, which is a Virginia
Well, in any court. Event, that was the Fourth Circuit's determination, wasn't it?
I think that is a reasonably fair statement. I think there's a little equivocation there. Yes, ma'am.
Don't we normally defer to a circuit court of appeals determination on state law issues and leave that alone?
I would think so, but the difficulty here, I think you had a flat-out decision by the Virginia Supreme Court, which is contrary to the Fourth Circuit, and the Fourth Circuit opinion, in my judgment, was a not too exhaustively reasoned opinion with respect to that. So that I think that it is not facetious for me to assert in this court that these facilities were, in effect, real property and not personal property. Manifestly, they are so massive and so connected that they have to be real property, and the case, Transcontinental, which was cited by both parties in this case, holds that underground gas mains are real property, and the rationale that the Fourth Circuit relied upon is a rather small point which wasn't really applied to the underground mains, but was applied to machinery that was in the Transcontinental case. That is the reason that I mentioned that here.
Is it essential to your argument that we disagree with the Court of Appeals with the Fourth Circuit about what kind of property?
There are three bases on which I would contend that the claim would be denied. That is one of them. I don't have to win on all three, but I think they are all three sound. The other two, the first one, is that the Act didn't cover utilities at all. This, I think, is the most compelling argument. The Uniform Act was passed after a decade of extensive congressional committee inquiry. It followed a prior decade when the highway statutes had been considered. During the 1950s, the federal aid highway statutes came along, and in those hearings, there was express and careful attention to the requirements of the utility companies. And the Highway Act contained Section 123, which dealt with utility companies. Contrarywise, during the 1960s, when the hearings were being held on the Uniform Relocation Act, there was no congressional inquiry into the plight of utilities.
Why do you suppose that is? It seems so strange that no discussion of that emerged.
The only reason that I can say is that the Congress was satisfied with the solution given by the Highway Act, because that solution, which was in Section 123, was retained. It was not changed.
But, of course, in the language of the Relocation Act, in defining a person, it did not admit of any exception. And I think it's just strange that there wouldn't be some reference in the legislative history to the utility problem.
I think it is strange that in all of those hearings with the hundreds, really, of representatives, that there was no movement by utilities to have had their particular problem addressed. I think that the overwhelming reason was that the Uniform Relocation Act dealt with the acquisition of private property, by and large, from individuals and small businesses. The CNP does not have private property. It does not have a compensable property interest in its franchise. The Fugate case by the Supreme Court of Virginia has held that their interest as a licensee does not amount to a compensable property interest. So that I think that the purpose of the Uniform Act was to help those people whose property was being taken by eminent domain and to supplement the benefits, the people who were getting fair market value under the principles of eminent domain were not being fairly treated. A hardware store, for example, that was in a redevelopment project, if their property was condemned, they would get the fair market value of the building. But unless they got relocation costs, they wouldn't get the cost to move to a new location. And they had to compete against another hardware store in the community who had the fair market value of their property. It hadn't been taken, but they didn't have to move. That was the kind of disproportionate burden that I think the committees looked into. The statistics are overwhelming that that's the sort of thing that they inquired about. I think the statute had primarily humanitarian interests. The small person, the mom-and-pop business, those things who moved personal property in the common, ordinary sense of personal property. I just don't see anywhere in this statute or its legislative history any contemplation of the problems of utility lines. And as the district court noted, this matter was not under the table or hidden or secret at all. There was a live controversy right across the Potomac in Virginia where Pepco and the Virginia Highway Commission were going through all sorts of litigation about this very matter. But it was related to Section 123 of the Highway Statute. So that I think that the Act just simply didn't contemplate it. When you compare the Uniform Act to actions of the Congress before the Highway Statute or actions of the Congress afterwards, in 1972, it adopted legislation which permitted relocation costs to utilities in the District of Columbia. Specifically, the committees just dealt with that problem. They recognized that if they didn't pass this, the utility companies would not be compensated. And that was 2 years after the Uniform Act. Again, this past May in the Senate, they have adopted amendments to this very statute that we're talking about. Now, I realize this is after this claim and after this decision, but still, it's the same committee of Congress, it's the same thrust that is being explained. And I think that the action by the Congress or the Senate this last May is very revealing about the congressional intent.
Does the Uniform Act apply to all federal condemnations?
Yes, it does.
Including highways?
Yes, it does. And with respect to the highways, it's interesting that Chapter 5 of the Highway Act was amended and repealed, but Section 123 of the Highway Act, which pertained to utilities, was left exactly as it was. And so that the Uniform Act came up and sat on top of Section 123. It refers to the comment by Justice Powell in the previous case. There you have a specific statute, Section 123, which deals with utility relocation. You have a general statute, the Uniform Relocation Act, which was passed in full knowledge of the highway statute, which says nothing about it. I think that simply shouts out that the Uniform Act does not contemplate utilities. And there are 21 federal agencies which administer some 50 programs that are affected by this act. None of them have regulations which pertain to utility relocation. HUD, which is the agency which was involved here, has a specific regulation that the relocation cost for a utility transmission line is not an eligible cost unless the state law requires it. And that regulation was in effect before the Uniform Act, it's in effect after the Uniform Act, and there was no change by HUD. So surely the agencies which interpret this act, as well as the utility companies and the localities, have dealt with this act as not including utilities. Now, there are two threshold requirements. I've alluded briefly to one. That is, you must move personal property. I contend that it is not personal property. I think these facilities manifestly are real property. But secondly, they weren't moved. When the street was discontinued, the collar to this vault that I described was destroyed. The vaults themselves were filled with sand and abandoned. The conduits were abandoned. And the cable, which was in the conduits, was withdrawn and sold for salvage where it was profitable to do so.
What expenses are, what relocation expenses, so-called, are they claiming? The cost of filling up the holes, for example?
No, Justice White, it's a little hard for me, honestly, to answer that because we haven't gotten into damages. The claims are very stark. They've not been fleshed out at all. But my impression of those claims is the cost of constructing in the new streets
the new facility. Example.
Right. So there isn't any movement from point A to point B, but it's a discontinuance in the old street and a new building job in the new street. It's a construction job, not a move. Now, I think the last threshold requirement is that the real property must be...
You don't think that if the city just closed the street, for example, and there wasn't any so-called move involved at all, there wouldn't be any claim in here.
Well, I'll say this. If the city simply closed the street and there was no redevelopment project, no acquisition...
Well, assume that Washington, D.C. builds a convention center, covers two or three blocks, and you can't go up and down 10th Street anymore. They closed that street. They built a building on it. I suppose the utilities took their... Suppose they filled up their manholes in that street. Under their claim in this case, they wouldn't have claimed anything.
I think they would have claimed, and the reason I say
that... Or just filling up the holes?
But no, they claim far more than filling up the hole. I mean, we give them the money to fill up the hole. But the point that they do, when they terminate a block here, they have to build a new block there because the service has got to be continuous. Ordinarily, these lines are through. They're not just serving little blocks. Mm-hmm. But these are transmission lines which go the extent of the city. Mm-hmm. And if you cut one here, you've got to loop it around so it connects to another place. You've got to keep the service going.
Well, unless you've already got a utility line in some other street that will serve the purpose.
Right. Now, I do think if they discontinued a line and did not connect somewhere else, I do not know of any claim, but we don't have that in this case.
All right.
I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. In the view of the United States, the Court of Appeals has misinterpreted the pertinent provisions of the Federal Uniform Relocation Assistance Act. It is our submission that that act was never intended to address the question of who should bear the cost of reconstructing utility lines when those lines are recreated in new locations because of local public improvements in the very streets in which they'd been located pursuant to local franchises.
Mr. Schwartz, the Solicitor General has changed his mind in this case from the time of the petition for certiorari. Am I correct?
There's been some change, Mr. Justice Blackmun.
Our
recommendation to the court most forthrightly was that the petition should be denied. I take it that is a moot question.
I'm not insisting that you don't have a right to change your mind, but I want to be sure about it.
We have to that degree. Certainly, the question is no longer presented whether the court should have granted the petition. The petition has been granted.
I know, but that isn't the extent of your prior position. Your prior position was that this was a reasonable construction of the statute.
If I may continue, Justice White, that's quite right.
You have changed your mind on that.
We have concluded that it is an erroneous construction of the statute. The position we urge is the same one we urge in the Court of Appeals. And if I might just say this, our reason for concluding that it is erroneous is based frankly, on a closer study of the statute, and we believe that we've identified concrete statutory language that this claim simply does not fit, so that contrary to what we said in that unfortunate brief we filed at the petition stage, this case simply does not, in our view, involve interpolating an exception into plain statutory language that covers the situation. That's what the Court of Appeals thought it involved, and if that were true, the Court of Appeals might be right. But we believe that the statutory requirement, which says that payment shall be made for moving of personal property or for moving oneself or one's business, simply cannot comfortably be made to cover the situation of reconstructing utility lines. And I think the words are important and the reality is important. This really is a construction job. The respondent, and I'll refer to C&P as the respondent, says in their answering brief that that we're in no position to deny that that their claims represent certain matters. And one of the things they say they represent are the cost of reconstructing those lines. I take that to be a concession that what we are talking about for the largest part is the cost of digging new trenches, pouring new concrete, installing new pipes, laying and installing new cables, and it seems to me that it would be a very odd choice of words indeed to use the words moving personal property if one wanted to describe those operations and paying for those costs. And if I might turn to something Justice O'Connor asked, it's not solely, the Court is not confronted necessarily with the question of whether the Fourth Circuit misunderstood Virginia law. There is a question here whether this equipment, these lines, are real or personal property. The government is skeptical of the Fourth Circuit's conclusion that it is all personal property. If the Court please, the petitioner has lodged with the clerk an illustration of a sample utility manhole, which is, as far as we can see, an underground building. And if you look closely at the Court of Appeals opinion, I would suggest that the Court of Appeals may have simply misunderstood what the physical equipment involved was and what the operation of replacing it was. The Court of Appeals appears to have believed that this equipment was removed from its location and transferred to a new location. Because of that misunderstanding, I think the ordinary deference to the Court of Appeals reading of state law is not required here. But even if it were, the question necessarily presented is a federal one, the question of what Congress meant by moving. That's the term of art in the federal statute, as to which there's no reason to believe that state law was intended to be controlling.
The problem, the difference between personal property and real property is determined by state law.
Ordinarily, we would say that would be true, but
ordinarily anyway. Do you know any other way to determine it?
If the federal statute indicated an intent otherwise, but in this case,
we
don't.
The federal statute say that property in Virginia, that a manhole in Virginia is personal property.
The federal statute doesn't.
Can a statute say that? A federal statute.
A federal statute could say that for the purposes of this statute, the term personal property shall include the following, and Congress could choose that manner of legislating. We're not suggesting that that's what it has done here.
Then next you can say a man is a woman in Virginia.
Congress probably could do that, Your Honor, but again, that's not the mode of analysis by which we proceed. Congress has used the term moving personal property or moving itself, and we think that that choice of language doesn't comfortably apply to this process of abandoning capital facilities and recreating new ones in new locations. We would submit that at a minimum, this language, moving personal property, is sufficiently ambiguous that it is not sufficient to stop with the statutory language, and it is sensible to go beyond it and look at the usual indicia of legislative intent. In this case, the first thing we're confronted by is the rather stark silence in the 10-year-long legislative record. And I might add that representatives of the American Right-of-Way Association, which represents the interests of utilities insofar as rights-of-way are concerned, did speak at the hearings on this, but they never suggested that this statute would or that it should alter the established common law rule. And accordingly, while this would be an easier case if someone had said the obvious, it appears to us that everyone understood that this issue, question of relocation assistance, was one that was governed by a well-established rule of state law, and that absent any indication of an intent to change it, Congress must have intended to leave it where it was, especially because in 1956, in the Highway Act, Congress had demonstrated that it was aware of the state law rule and that it chose for Highway Act purposes to defer to that state law rule. Now, the Uniform Relocation Act does not say, except insofar as provided by other law, the following payments shall be made. It says all federal acquisitions shall be controlled and federally assisted acquisitions shall be controlled by this statutory scheme. Given that, it is difficult for us to understand why Congress apparently quite deliberately left in effect the provisions of the Highway Act, which said thou may pay relocation assistance, but only if state law provides for it. And if there were any question left in the wake of that action, in 1972, when Congress turned to the question again in the District of Columbia Public Utilities Reimbursement Act, when Congress provided specifically for the purposes of interstate highways that these monies should be paid, that portion of the statute would have had precisely no effect and would have been entirely superfluous if the Uniform Relocation Act in 1970 had set aside the rule of Section 123 of the Highway Act. As it happens, Congress did set aside other provisions of the Highway Act, Title 23, Sections 501 and the following sections, which dealt with other provisions of relocation assistance. So one can't even say that Congress might have overlooked the Highway Act. If you go through this statute, and if you go through the House and Senate committee reports, you'll find an extraordinarily detailed listing set out in hec verba of each of the statutory texts that was repealed, and many sections of the Highway Act are to be found there. It's just very difficult for me to believe that Congress just missed this. It appears that Congress chose to leave Section 123 and its rule, which defers to state law, in effect. There's another thing that one can garner from looking at the several occasions on which Congress has addressed the question of relocation assistance. Congress has used different language to speak to this. In the District of Columbia Act of 1972, Congress spoke of abandoning, relocating, reconstructing, reestablishing, and used a large number of terms which speak to the capital building process.
Mr. Schwartz, did that bill go through the same committee that this bill, the Uniform Relocation Act, would have gone through?
Justice Rehnquist, I don't know the answer to that
question. I wonder how relevant it is if you don't really have any knowledge that the same individuals on a committee compared the two and chose to leave them the way they were.
Well, I think we have something special because we have there are three stages to this. There's Section 123, there's the Uniform Act, and there's the D.C. Act. While perhaps the action of one committee in 1972 doesn't say that much about what the 1970 Congress thought, the entire statute that was enacted would have been of no effect at all. And I would question whether we ought to attribute that intent to Congress in 1972. We would suggest that when Congress wishes to address this subject, it knows how to do so, and that it did not do so in the Uniform Relocation Act, and that the judgment of the Court of Appeals accordingly should be reversed.
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I believe it. We should first make quite clear that there is no uncertainty on the record in this case about the nature of the telephone company's claim, the nature of the expenses for which it claimed. There's no need to speculate from what is said in the briefs or whether they correctly describe them. Those claims were filed from the at the in the beginning and have been in the possession of both the petitioner and the federal defendant since that time and still are. Those claims are for the non-betterment cost of reconstructing, the non-betterment cost of moving utility lines, a completely familiar concept that is observed and applied every day. It involves the determining the true cost of moving by starting with the cost of rebuilding, which is inevitably required whenever you move a line, a utility line, for the most part, unless there happen to be overhead poles that can be moved bodily or wires that can be moved and used again, which would be exceptional, but in all at all events, under in the multitude of cases in which a utility company moves its lines at the expense of someone else, whether by contract or under voluntary arrangement at the time, the parties well understood here from the beginning, from the time these claims were filed, as they understood when they stipulated that a similar expense, if it happened to be a municipal system, stipulated in those words in this case, that the non-betterment cost, if it happened to be a municipal line, is part of the cost of the project, or must is counted as the city's share, against the city's share of the total project cost. So there should not be any uncertainty about the fact that this case, from the beginning, has involved claims for the relocation, for moving the lines in the only sense in which most industrial or large, most, the facilities of most displaced persons which happen to use heavy or large equipment and structures which are not part of the land taken because they are severed from it by agreement or by law, as the Fourth Circuit has determined that these were severed by law. They were personal property. Since they are not taken, then the expense of moving them, relocating them, would be one of those inequitable expenses and burdens borne by a particular class of people instead of being borne.
Mr. Kelly, you used the word moving them a moment ago in your argument. These facilities were never moved, were they?
They were not. They were moved in the sense in which that term is most frequently used, in the same sense in which it is used if the hardware store referred to in Mr. Crenshaw's brief had been the property of the hardware store owner, severed from the land by agreement, and he had a right to move it, or if some structure that was part of it, he had a right to remove from the land. It did not belong to the owner of the land that was taken.
Are there two manholes out there where there used to be one?
Two manholes, Your Honor, yes. Where there used to be one?
Yes.
No, Your Honor, the facilities that were moved were simply duplicated by construction in a new place.
Did exactly. They take up the manhole and move the manhole to another place?
The manholes were not dug out of the ground and lifted and transferred to another place.
Well, how can... So they weren't moved, were they?
They were not... There was no physical movement of them from one spot to another. I submit that the language of the Act, when it refers to moving personal property, has to apply, if the Act is to mean any, have be intelligible at all, to the same hardware, for instance, to the same hardware store operators, store cases, showcases, other trade fixtures which he has the right to move, but which it is not sensible, not economically feasible for him to move bodily to the new place. But no one would doubt that he has, within the meaning of that Act, move those structures and facilities when he takes them down and scraps or abandons them when it's not practical to move them bodily, and rebuilds and reconstructs them in a new place.
Is there anything in the legislative history that will help you?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor. I couldn't hear you.
Is there anything in the legislative history that will help you?
I'm so sorry, Your Honor. I could not hear.
Is there anything in the interpretive history that will help you in saying that this is what you mean by moving?
By moving personal property.
Yes, sir. You've cited us a hardware case. What else do you have?
The fact that in common acceptation, when one of the tower lines constructed on one man's land in sight of us all is taken down and rebuilt on another man's land, the whole world would say the company has moved its power line.
But if you had a power line on one land and build a brand new power line on another man's land, that wouldn't be moving it, would it?
Yes, I think, Your Honor, it would be. If you
would
be
not.
We would all still say the company has moved its power line. Now, it should not be, we should not from that proceed to the assumption that a statute authorizing payment for the cost of moving that line would entitle anyone to be paid for building himself a new line. The whole cost of that, which might be a much bigger, better, and newer line than the old one, and that is not the cost that was claimed here. It is not the cost that all utility companies have always claimed when they were admittedly entitled, to claim the non-betterment cost of moving. You start with the cost of the new construction, must deduct from it the unused, the value, any difference in value between that new line and the value of the old one that they gave up. You don't get the benefit of new construction. Under our claims, don't claim it. Under our interpretation of the Act, the displaced person doesn't get the benefit of new construction. He gets the cost of replacing what can't be moved. But it is not part of his cost of just moving if he builds a better one. That's the cost of an improvement, which he cannot claim and should not receive. But he has moved any shed structure of any kind which he had a right to take. It was not taken with the land because it belonged to someone else. And that's why it was personal property. He did not take it with him to the new land. But if
Mr. Kelly, when you look at Section 202, A, that's quoted in the government's, the appendix to the government's brief, but I'm sure you're familiar with the statute. It talks about whenever the acquisition of real property, et cetera, and then it tells what you can recover for. And the first is actual reasonable expenses, the second is actual direct losses, and the third is actual reasonable expenses in searching for a replacement business. Does your claim come under A1?
It comes under A1, Your Honor.
You're not claiming that it's actual direct losses of 10.
That it is what, Your Honor?
You're not claiming under 2, then, that it's actual direct losses of tangible personal property as a result of moving.
The figure representing that loss would appear in these claims in only one indirect way. When you're determining what was the cost of relocating this utility line from the old land it used to be on to the land it's on now, you start with the cost of building the new line. You deduct from that difference between the value of that new line and the old one that you gave up. You must deduct also the salvage value
I don't know where you get that measure of damages under 1, which simply talks about actual reasonable expenses in moving himself, his family, business, farm operation, or other personal property. It doesn't seem to allow the kind of computation you make.
Well, it's because, Your Honor, the same statement, these same claims. We do it, although we do argue and do still, it is still our position that they are the cost of moving these utility lines. They, the same thing.
It doesn't say cost, but the statute doesn't say cost, it says expenses.
I beg your pardon, the expense of moving the line. It is not only the expense of moving the lines, it is equally as true that those same expenses are the expense of moving a business.
But if you don't move your line at all, if you don't move the physical personal property out of the ground, how can you have any actual reasonable expenses incurred in moving it?
Well, if that view of the expense of moving personal property were accepted, which we still contest. If that were accepted, the same figures still represent the expense of moving a business, which is defined in the statute very carefully, so as to mean any legitimate activity of business can't be physically moved. It's an activity. It's not a thing physically.
So what section of the statute is it that defines carefully the expenses incurred in moving a business?
4601, subparagraph 7.
Is that in your brief? Do you know?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. It's in the appendix, the appendix to the government's brief. It's in the opening pages of our brief on the merits. It's 46017. And it is every expense claimed was also, we think it was an expense of moving a utility line. Whether it was or not, it was assuredly an expense of moving the lawful activity of using these lines in the land where they used to be used to serve the public. That is what the statute carefully defines as the meaning of the word business wherever used in the Act. It was most assuredly the cost of moving that business activity.
All I see, I'm looking now on the statute involved section of your brief, the red brief, at page Roman 7 and Roman 8. And all I see set up for 7 is that the term business means any lawful activity excepting a farm operation conducted primarily for the sale of services to the public.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's not all of that section, but it is the business that we moved. And then 4622A provides for that payment shall be made for the cost not only of moving personal property. In this case, happened to be the same thing. It's the cost of moving a business, which is that lawful activity that we were conducting on that property, and also for the cost of just moving. And in the case of any business organization, the only business corporation, partnership, or association cannot physically move. It has no physical existence. And
But now, you've got a proviso in 2. 4622A2,
yes.
Where you say you can also include actual direct losses of tangible personal property as a result of moving or discontinuing a business. But then it goes on to say, but not to exceed an amount equal to the reasonable expenses that would have been required to relocate such property as determined by the head of the agency. So that sets a ceiling on the kind of damage you're claiming the amount that you have expenses you have incurred to relocate.
No, Your Honor, I think it does not. I think the clear sense of that section is altogether different from that. It sets a ceiling on an expense we do not claim here. No item of our claim is for the loss of property we left. The sense of that section, too, is to cover the very common situation very likely to arise in which the owner of property that is not taken because it's not part of the land is still, like these manholes, not feasible to move bodily. The owner may just abandon and give up. He may never find another place for part of his business, and yet he's a displaced person because he moved his business. He just didn't move that part, and he abandoned and lost it in place. Now, if he didn't and never reconstructed it anywhere or in any other sense moved it, in such case, he just loses that property, and that would be an expense borne by him, not borne by anyone else. And yet one of the burdens, the expenses that that project required some persons to pay. And the sense of the act is that he should be reimbursed for that loss. That
well, Mr. Kelly, I guess the lower courts haven't resolved these questions yet, have they? They just were dealing with whether the utilities were covered at all, and then we're going to send it back to resolve some of these things.
They have not considered these questions except to the extent that they are necessarily included in the legal conclusion that a company in moving its facilities has moved, or at least has moved its business, or has moved its personal property from one place to another. We think it moved all three. It has not considered them directly because the contention that we have not moved our facilities was never made in the lower court or in any of the administrative proceedings and was stipulated by the parties, alleged in the complaint that we did move all of our facilities, admitted in the answer that we did move all of our facilities, stipulated that we did move all of our facilities, stipulation agreed to by all the parties. The significance of that fact, I do not contend that the parties, the petitioner and the government bound themselves by the legal conclusions involved in that use of those terms. It is highly significant, though, to my contention that that's the usual and ordinary acceptation of the word moved its facilities when we're dealing with any displaced person whose facilities, whose personal property includes property of such physical nature that it needs to be rebuilt in a new place.
Mr. Kelly, may I ask you a question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Am I correct in believing that the Court of Appeals did not rely on the provision that pertains to the moving of a business? They relied on the moving of personal property, as I remember the opinion. Is that right?
They did not mention
4637.
Removal of personal property, although they very plainly regarded that the reconstruction of these lines was amounted to moving the lines.
But moving the lines,
they
the question,
fully understood.
But the question whether it's moving a business, they didn't really face up to.
It was never discussed.
Yeah. Because one might argue, I don't know whether it's right or not, that thinks in terms of moving an entire business or moving a facility or something like
it that. That point is indeed argued in the reply briefs. One reason, the courts below did not consider any of these contentions now being made as to the meaning of the expression moved in the case of a business, of a corporation, moved from land, moved personal property from land when in fact they had to be rebuilt elsewhere. Didn't consider any of those because they were made for the first time in the government's brief on the merits and never once advanced before in a court will review the pleadings, the stipulations. It's perfectly apparent that we were all agreed then that the utility company here, telephone company, had moved its lines to the new places. Moved all of its facilities to the new places, stipulated in so many words.
Did they agree that the move of the personal property was a move made as a result of the acquisition of real estate?
That's the one thing they did not. The answers denied, although the government didn't agree with this. That is, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, on the administrative review, disagreed. They contended that we didn't move as a result of the acquisition. But they admitted that the removal of the all of these facilities occurred. That's expressly admitted in the answers. Well, alleged and in the complaint, admitted in the answers, and stipulated in the stipulation of facts.
Can I go back to my original point? Does the record still show that there were two manholes?
I think that all the testimony makes clear that the manholes were abandoned and left in the ground.
Well, how in the world can you say you moved them?
In the same sense in which, we say they rented the building, the shed which one company has rented and used for years to store machinery on the land of another, afterwards rebuilds on a new place, we all say the company has moved its shed to the new place.
In case if we can put a grain elevator into Cape Commerce, we can do that.
It is indeed possible, and under this view of what is meant by move, the utility companies and all other displaced companies, including the chainsaw company involved in the Beard Poulon case, discussed where they moved the whole plant. Now, they didn't pick that plant up and move it, Your Honor. They didn't pick much up and move it. They moved the whole plant. And the court concluded that the Beard Poulon moved. And in an answer, it's also the answer to the suggestion that maybe you have to move your entire business. The chainsaw plant was most assuredly not the only business of the Emerson Company. That's why the statute was so careful to define what activity is, what business means. It means any activity conducted for a business purpose. And that activity was moved. Whether we all could agree that the company moved, that's what everyone would say in common parlance, and that the power line was moved, or the underground lines were moved, that's what everyone would say in common parlance, we say that's what the act meant. Whether we could all agree on that or not, most assuredly the activity was moved to the new location. Now, I trust the court understands that from the time when these cases were first, when these claims were first filed, right through 3 years, I cannot recall how many years of administrative consideration of those claims, 2 years in the trial court, a total of 3 years in litigation, the party seemed to be fully agreed that we had moved the lines and that we had moved. There was never any contention to the contrary ever asserted. And that continued to be true down through the time when the government's first brief was filed, not having declined to join in the petition for writ of error. The government's position was not quite fully stated just now by the Solicitor General. The statement there twice was that the plain terms of the Act, that the Court of Appeals had merely followed the plain terms of the Act. Nothing has happened. At that point, the Department of Justice had been defending this litigation on behalf of the United States for more than 3 years. It had, in the trial court, supported the administrative interpretation till the Fourth Circuit held that it was contrary to the plain terms of the Act, after which the government, the Solicitor General concluded and informed the court in its brief in opposition that the Court of Appeals cannot be said to have erred in following the plain language of the Act, and that the arguments to the contrary of the petitioner and the amici supporting the petitioner were made despite the Act's plain terms. Nothing has been said to explain how in the next 5 months the Act's plain terms became any less plain.
signed by the same solicitor.
I think attention should be called to the anomalous consequences that would arise out of any interpretation of the word moved personal property in this, or moved property here, that would limit it to the case when it can be bodily transplanted. The law was never intended to treat differently the power company that digs, the gas company that digs up its lines and moves them and uses them again, and the one who, because it's not feasible and not sensible to do that, puts new ones in the new place and recovers only for the difference, and seeks compensation only for the difference between the old and the new, for the loss, the actual cost of putting itself back where it was by reconstructing and relocating its facilities in a new place.
Do you have anything further, counsel, by way of rebuttal?
I have just a couple of words, if I might, sir.
One, and I would like to call to the court's attention that the complaint at paragraph 7 alleges that these lines were moved. The redevelopment authority's answer at paragraph 7 denies those allegations. In the stipulation at paragraph, that's at page 21 of the joint appendix. In the stipulation, we refer to the term relocated facilities as the cables, lines, poles, or other equipment which CMP has removed. And then we stipulate that any that have been removed were removed subject to January the 2nd. I don't think we have articulated well our argument on removal, but it certainly has been in the case. The second thing I'd like to say is that this statute was passed to supplement benefits of people whose private property was taken. In this case, we're dealing with the acquisition or the removal or reconstruction of lines in public property. The public street was where the lines were. When the streets were closed, the Redevelopment Authority owned them. It's a political subdivision of the state. It's still public property. Nowhere in this are we talking about taking a compensable property interest. And the telephone company has not cited, and I don't believe they can, cite any case in which benefits under the relocation statute are conferred unless there is the acquisition of a compensable interest in real property. We think the claim should be denied. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.